From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And this morning, Chris, we turn to ferns.
Yes, and we speak with scientists Fei Wei Li and Jacob Suisa about their new book, Ferns: Lessons in Survival from Earth's Most Adaptable Plants. This book explores the incredible world of these fascinating plants, which, although they bear no flower, fruit, or seed, have managed to survive for nearly 400 million years and continue to find ways to adapt to an ever-changing planet.
Super interesting. And then in the second part of this show, we will be revisiting our interview with author and correspondent for the New York Times, Kara Jamo. Jamo will be discussing her most recent book, Atlas Obscura: Wildlife. In the book, Jamo takes readers on epic journeys around the globe, from Antarctic deserts to lush jungles. And yeah, Antarctic deserts, which is really fascinating.
That's right.
Lush jungles and the deepest fathoms of the oceans.
All of that and some news about farmers in Africa that produce some of the world's most prized coffee are in a scramble to comply with new European Union environmental rules that require them to document the origin of every shipment of beans. We'll explain why later on in the show.
Ooh, a cliffhanger.
Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about.
Today, joining us, we have Fei Wei Li and Jacob Suisa, who have just penned a new book called Ferns: Lessons in Survival from Earth's Most Adaptable Plants. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Well, we're excited to dive into this book. We like to first set the stage, though, with the authors and who you are and how you came into these fields. So, Fei Wei, why don't we start with you? Why don't you give us your background and what led you on this path or this direction?
Yeah, so I grew up in Taiwan, beautiful islands, subtropical islands. There's just tons of ferns there. There are over 800 or almost 900 species of ferns and lycophytes in Taiwan. And my parents have a house in the forest, and I spent my childhood running around and realized, oh, wow, there's this really beautiful creatures. And so I wanted to identify them. So I got a really nice field book and trying to identify ferns. And then I kind of just started from there. Went to college, studying ferns in college. My PhD from Duke University, also studying ferns. We name a fern species after a fern genus, actually, after Lady Gaga, and that's my 5 minutes of fame out of that. Yeah, I'm currently also the president for American Fern Society, which is a really fun, tight-knit society.
Oh, okay. And Jacob, tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, so I grew up right outside D.C., sort of the swamps of Maryland, so to speak, along the Potomac River. And I, like Fei Wei, sort of romped around the woods, but I wasn't into ferns yet. I went to do my undergrad at the University of Vermont. It was there where I was sort of exposed to ferns by a professor I had, Dr. David Barrington. He took me on a course to Costa Rica, where I explored, I guess, a bit of what Fei Wei experienced in Taiwan, right? Sort of this tropical environment. And I sort of, you know, from there fell in love with plant biodiversity. And because the people who were teaching me were sort of fern nerds, the bug bit me, so to speak. And then from there, I ended up going to graduate school at Harvard, where I studied fern biology. And then I ended up with Fei Wei for my postdoc at the Boyce Thompson Institute and Cornell, where this story starts, I suppose.
All right, well, let's get a little background on ferns. What makes a fern, say, compared to other plant species?
That's a great question.
Thank you.
So there's several things, right? I mean, I think the first is this sort of evolutionary perspective, right? Which is that they share a common ancestor and they are more closely related to each other than they are to any other group of organisms. But of course, ferns also lack flowers and fruits. And we sort of tend to frame that maybe in a more positive light, right? They don't need flowers or fruits to survive. They've done just fine without them for 400 million years or so. they have sort of what we call true large leaves, often multi-veined leaves. There are, of course, many reversions and exceptions to that. They have true vascular tissue, right? This is what separates them from things like the mosses and other groups like that, mm-hmm. and a variety of other fascinating traits, aspects of their genomes that, of course, Fei Wei can speak, you know, more to.
Yeah, ferns has been very confusing to a lot of people historically because they don't have flowers, they don't have seeds. So people have no idea how they reproduce. And so the legend was like, if you were able to find the fern seeds, they believe that fern seeds are invisible. And if you were able to hold onto a fern seed, you'll be invisible as well. It was until 18th century that people finally figured out, 19th century finally figured out, they were produced by spores.
Ah, okay, spores. But interesting, no flower, no fruit. Is that one of the reasons why they've been so adaptable and resilient over millions of years? They seem very uncomplicated in that way.
It depends on what you mean by complicated.
Yeah.
To us, ferns are super complicated. Their biology are fascinating, even though they have flowers, right? We tend to think they're unburdened by the flowers, they're unburdened by the seeds. They can do whatever they want. They disperse by spores, right? Spores are light, and a single spores can land in a faraway places, and a single spores can give rise to a whole new population of ferns.
Mm.
So in a sense, the way they disperse can be really far away, far-reaching.
The other thing, so to your point, there's probably not one reason, right, why ferns are so, let's say, adaptable in air quotes, right? There's aspects of their genome. They have massive genomes and duplication events and such, which again, Fei Wei is the expert on that. But to your point about flowers and fruits, you know, I think I like to think of the flowering plants as sort of signing a deal with the devil, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. They have these flowers and these fruits, which allow them to have these really tight-knit co-evolutionary histories with animals,
right?
Which has many people have demonstrated this sort of can spur diversification and speciation, but it also sort of inexorably links you to another group, right? Like if you're sort of speciating and radiating because your floral morphology is shifting with co-pollinators and your fruits are being dispersed, you're kind of linked, right? And stuck and then your fate is tied. So to speak, with those lineages. And ferns have sort of, as Fei Wei was saying, they don't have flowers, they don't have fruits, they disperse by spore, and they're more or less, in terms of their reproduction, unburdened by the sort of relationships that flowering plants have with animals for sex.
So we talk a lot about how climate affects different species, animal species, plant species, but it sounds like if they've been around for, 400 million years, and there's 11,000 different species, what are their chances of survival, and are they higher and why?
Well, if you look at the state of Utah, for example, right, you have amazing fern diversity, but in really unusual places, you have deserts, and there's tons of ferns in the Utah desert.
Really?
And it's because they adapted to like really dry environments, and they figure out how to survive. How to diversify, and how to thrive in that environment. And in fact, you know, Utah, Arizona, they have the highest fern diversity in the whole United States. And that's because that really weird habitats that drive the ferns' evolutions. You know, ferns usually, you associate ferns with wet and shady environments.
Right.
But, you know, they figure out how to live in the desert. So I think I'm pretty positive ferns can figure things out.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm really curious if there are any ferns in deserts, but the answer is an obvious yes. I just don't look for them, or no one's ever pointed them out to me. So that's a really fascinating thing that Utah has. Lots of ferns, not like you say in its more typical areas, up in the wet, you know, forest firs and spruce pine forests, etc.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you want to ask how a lineage or you know, ferns in particular are going to respond to future change, it's important to sort of look into the past, right? And what's really interesting when you look at the sort of evolutionary history of ferns is that they had several major, what we would call sort of radiations or diversification events. Their first was about 370 million years ago in sort of the Carboniferous period. That's when you start seeing them in the fossil record, and they start you know, diversifying in shapes and forms. But then they kind of have a little bit of a lull for about 200 million years or so, right? When seed plants and then are hypothesized to be dominant. And then around during the Cretaceous time, so sort of about 150 million years ago or so, flowering plants evolved. And there's some really nice work from our colleagues that demonstrated that ferns had another radiation when the flowering plant forest sort of came to be. Mm. Ferns actually jumped, or that radiation was really about sort of thriving in the shady environments. And then they had another radiation when they sort of in the Cenozoic, when they jumped up into the canopy and grew as epiphytes. So this idea of sort of how will ferns respond, I think it's better reflected, or it is reflected in looking at how they have responded to sort of massive changes throughout time. And time and time again, they evolve different ways of living and different ways of being. And sometimes that leads to diversification events.
We are speaking with Jacob Suisa and Fei Wei Li, who have just written the book, Ferns, Lessons in Survival from Earth's Most Adaptable Plants. And I am curious, how did you decide what was going to go in the book? Because it sounds like this is such a vast topic and there's so much to speak about. How did you break this down and get together and even start and design it into something that people could pick up and absorb?
Well, both really fascinated by how ferns adapt to really bizarre and environments. And so we kind of break it down to emphasize ferns in different habitats, right? We have a chapter about how ferns adapt to the desert environments, how ferns adapt to the water environments. And of course, we have to talk about ferns and humans as well, right? So I don't know, Jacob, how do we decide on?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think we kind of broke it down just in that way, right? We sort of describe what a fern is. Right. And then we talked about, as Fei was saying, like we essentially try to tell the story of these often misunderstood creatures, right?
Right.
And we talk about ferns diversifying and living on trees. And then we sort of actually talk about how ferns grew into trees. There's a whole group of ferns that we call tree ferns. We talk about fern interactions with animals, which we often don't think about those interactions. As Fei Wei was saying, ferns in the desert, ferns in human, with, you know, in human affairs, and so on and so forth. And the other thing that's important though is we collaborated with one of UK's leading botanical illustrators, Laura Silburn, who did all of the illustrations in this book. And as you know, if you flip through it, you'll start to see that there are her fascinating watercolors. So it was actually a collaborative endeavor with all three of us, and to try to think about, you know, what are the stories we want to tell? What are the species we want to highlight? And what's the material that Laura can get to actually illustrate these plants, right? Because a huge component of this work is her fantastic illustrations.
Yeah, the illustrations are absolutely stunning. They're beautiful.
Are there ferns that are, let's say, edible? Are there cultures that, you know, use them as a source of food or maybe as a source of medicine?
Yeah. Again, I guess in Utah, you have bracken ferns, right? Pteridium acaulinum. And some people in Japan or in East Asia, they will eat it. But it turns out it has really high loads of carcinogens. There's a public health study showing that the more you eat bracken ferns, the more likely you get stomach cancers. That's the bracken ferns in part of the country. And in the eastern United States, we have the ostrich ferns. And now it's the springtime. It's a prime time right now to pick fiddle heft. And they are fine to eat, and this is actually one of the biggest, most popular foraging plants here. And it tastes like slimy asparagus. pretty good.
Well, that's two strikes against it. I got to be honest with you there. That's not a good
start. It's an acquired taste.
Come on. It's great. It's delicious.
I'm sure it's great with barbecue sauce or whatever, you know, your favorite.
A little bit
dressing,
of salt.
A lot of, you know, Thousand Island. But the point is that, yes, there are forms that are edible. And I, like any plants, I'm sure there are other forms that you want to stay away from. How about there are benefits. You mentioned, kind of alluded to it, Jacob. There are benefits that ferns bring to ecosystems. Other, let's say, animals, maybe birds, insects use ferns as a source of habitat or food, et cetera?
Yeah, so there's a couple things there. The first is that, so in certain ecosystems, ferns can form the dominant herbaceous understory, particularly in the Northeast, for instance, or the East Coast. Which is where Feiwei and I are. You walk into a forest and the entire, you know, herbaceous understory are wood ferns or hay-scented fern or something like that. And what we know is that the herbaceous understory can actually disproportionately affect nutrient cycling in the soils. Mm. So they have a lot of organic matter that dies and gets recycled, you know, quite often, as opposed to trees, which have all this biomass and that don't contribute as much to nutrient cycling. So that's one sort of ecological importance of ferns. And the other is that there's some fascinating work from done at the Harvard Forest by George and Lisa George and Bazaz back in the 80s or 90s, I believe. And they had this lovely set of papers that were entitled Ferns as an Ecological Filter. Mm. And what was really cool about this study when I read it was that, you normally walk through the woods and you see all these trees and all these ferns and you're like, wow, I see this fern growing under this tree. I wonder what it is about this forest that sort of allows the fern to grow there. Right. But what they demonstrated actually is that in a post-disturbance in a ecosystem, you know, let's say a forest fire or trees fell down or whatever, the ferns usually sort of get there first or right. They are first. They're mm-hmm. sort of these disturbance colonizers and they can actually determine which tree seedlings or which tree seeds will germinate and the distribution of those seedlings. So actually it's the ferns that can in some capacity determine what the forest structure looks like. And then of course there's positive feedbacks and then they iterate on themselves, so on and so forth. But those are some of the ecological important aspects of ferns at the sort of forest level.
So they can be predictors of what may be to come, but also tell us history and then the health of what's happening in that ecosystem at the time.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, that's really fascinating.
It's very fascinating.
They're like directors. So you're suggesting that they also would say, oh, no, not these plants. I prefer these plants to start to populate, repopulate or burn scar.
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much that they're, you know, making the decisions like that more right. so than, you know, there are species that grow. So, for instance, hay-scented fern, let's just say it has these long creeping underground rhizomes that can form these pretty dense, large patches. And maybe, an oak can germinate there, but a pine can't, let's just say, right, just for a variety of reasons, you know.
So they're informative. So if you were to go into an area with these ferns in this ecosystem, they really are an educator about what is happening at that time in that place.
Yeah, and what has happened.
And what has happened.
Well, are you witnessing changes in range, either, you know, one direction or another, or fern survival or with respect to a warming world?
Well, there are some ferns that are very invasive, and probably some of the invasiveness have some correlation with the climate change. Mm. So, for example, there's a giant Salvinia molasta, that has been causing a lot of troubles in pretty much all parts of the world. It's an aquatic fern. It doubles its biomass every other day and can just occupy the whole lake and choking the lake. All the fishing villages got impacted. So in that sense, yes, some ferns can become invasive as a response to this. They jump out of their comfort zones and realize, other places are good for me too. Yeah.
Is there range pretty much all continents? Maybe, I don't know, except the Antarctica?
Yeah. So it's in Australia, in South Africa, lots of places in East Asia. Also, in the southern United States, Louisiana, Texas is causing a lot of issues.
Well, what's fascinating is yes, certain species ranges are expanding. You know, there's other examples like the climbing fern in Florida and such. But also, you know, we can kind of flip that question on its head a little bit and ask, how have ferns changed the climate? And so, Feiwei, do you want to talk about the Azolla event?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mentioned Sophia molasta, right? And it's kind of a, not a closely related species called Azolla. It's a sister genus. Azolla is fascinating. Around 50 million years ago, the geologists realized there was a huge Azolla bloom, and that happens in the now Arctic. So Arctic back then was a big freshwater lake. And Azolla pretty much occupied the whole Arctic lake, and it sequestered 10 trillion of carbon dioxide with it, and then it sank to the bottom of the lake. And the climate scientists believe that the events, they call Azolla events, actually cool down the Earth because they fix so much carbon and then sink to the bottom of the lake.
Wow. So I guess we can suggest that they could play a pretty important role in helping sequester carbon, plenty of carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere in our in bodies of water right now.
Yeah, I've done it once. Maybe we can enlist it to do it again. So there's a lot of active research on Azolla. How do they grow? How do they sequester that much carbon? They also have symbiosis with cyanobacteria, and that's for fixing nitrogens, so they can fix both, right? That's very unique combinations. So yeah, it's a very, very interesting organism to do research on.
Do farmers use ferns as, say, a cover crop or so? Is it possible?
Exactly. Yeah. That's what people have been using Azolla for. So in rice farmings in Vietnam, in China, in Taiwan, they usually, before they plant out the rice, they will flood their paddies with water, and they put Azolla there, and the Azolla will fix nitrogens, and then they will drain the water from the paddies, and Azolla will come to the soil and decompose and release all the fixed nitrogen. So kind of like alfalfa in a way, right? Like I said, the cover crops. And then they plant the rice. So it's a natural nitrogen fertilizer.
Can we get them to grow, say, in like the Great Salt Lake or something like that? Or I'm trying to think of something. We grow a lot of alfalfa here in the state of Utah, and alfalfa uses a lot of water. And all that alfalfa goes to feed cattle, the great majority of it. I'm trying to think of an alternative to growing alfalfa, unless ferns take up even more water than alfalfa.
Well, in that sense, yes, that's aquatic ferns, so okay. Probably will need a lot of water. Yeah. Okay.
All right, that was an idea. I just thought I'd throw that out there.
I'm curious as to what we as humans can glean from these ferns. What can we learn from them, maybe to utilize for ourselves?
Well, so ferns, a lot of ferns, they don't get eaten by insects. And scientists have been really curious about why insects don't like to eat ferns. And there are some big agricultural companies put a lot of resources into looking at why ferns are resistant to insect herbivories. And there was a recent paper that they published. They actually figured out why they are so resistant. And there's a protein that kill insects. They isolated from ferns. And so this become a big deal because then you can then breed this into crops and then make crops resistant to herbivories. So that's one way, fern research can help improve our world. There's another ferns that live can tolerate really high arsenic concentrations in the soil.
Wow.
But like it can accumulate up to 1 to 2% of their dry weight is pure arsenic.
Wow.
And arsenic is a really toxic stuff in the soil. You can use ferns to detoxify your soil by just growing ferns on the arsenic contaminated regions.
Oh, that's great. When I lived in Florida, no shortage of golf courses down there, and a lot of golf courses use arsenic-based pesticides.
Really? Okay.
Until they were, I don't know if they were banned or somewhat limited or they moved on. So as an environmental engineer, we always knew kind of the open secret was that one of the most contaminated properties in your neighborhood is going to be your golf course, because all the arsenic that was there and seeping into the groundwater. So if there's golf maintenance folks listening, maybe some ferns.
Turn toward ferns. Turn to the fern. That's going to be.
Oh, there you go. Vine two.
The new marketing. Turn to the fern.
There you go. That's a good one. I think another interesting point there, though, is, so what we really tried to do with this book is share fern stories and sort of, there are a lot of utilitarian aspects of ferns and fern research that we can point to, but also just, you know, a deeper care for them as these organisms that are, again, often misunderstood, right? And that's what we really tried to do in this book, is share their stories. And mm-hmm. so if we can care a little bit more about these odd creatures, right, I think that helps with sort of this conservation mindset, right? Because you start thinking about not what this organism or these organisms can do for me, but rather what can I do to live in a world with 11,000 fern species, right? And what do we have to do to conserve land and protect biodiversity, right? And so right. I think there's a slew of utilitarian aspects here, but also, you know, we live in a world with immense diversity of 11,000 ferns, and you know, let's keep it that way.
We talk about that a lot here on This Green Earth, protecting and taking care of and understanding and living among what is natural to our planet, and making sure that we're not just stepping on it or using it for our own good, but also understanding that right. in the long run, this really is for the best of all of us, is to make sure that planets and animals thrive.
Right.
Yeah, and it's not just sort of trivial, right? Like all the things that Feiwei was describing, that's just the tip of the iceberg for what we know that ferns could do for humanity, right? So even if you do want to sort of take this full utilitarian approach, the conservation aspect is paramount for that, because mm-hmm. we don't know barely anything, right, about the biochemistry of ferns, their genomics, their sort of function and evolution, and that's sort of what Feiwei and I have dedicated our lives to in some capacity, right, trying to figure out that and tease it apart.
Last minute or so, 11,000 species plus or minus, you think there's more species to be discovered?
Oh yeah. In Utah, I think this has been several new species being described from the desert, right?
Wow.
So next time you go on a hike in the Utah deserts,
yeah.
Some ferns might look crispy dry, but when you have a rainfall, they will come back alive.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and that's also, we have some colleagues that are doing great work. This is sort of where the super foundational boots on the ground collecting work is done, right? So going out, documenting which species are where, finding new species and new species to science, and you know, naming them and sort of giving them a platform, right? And we have a couple colleagues who have a National Science Foundation grant to collect ferns in Colombia. And they have done an amazing job so far, of course, collaborating with many local institutions there and doing their work ethically, of course. But they've already discovered, you know, probably a dozen more fern species that are not published yet, but are out there, and many, many new records of species that are previously, you know, undescribed from a particular place. So this kind of work is still happening, just yeah. the descriptive phase of things. And it's extremely important for anything that's sort of more applied than just describing a species, right? You need to know what's there to be able to study it. So
I smell a field trip, Chris. This Green Earth has to go on a field trip.
For down to the desert.
Yeah.
With the ferns.
Yes.
Let's do it. But right now, again, the name of the book is Ferns, Lessons in Survival from Earth's Most Adaptable Plants. Oh, and again, I meant no slight by suggesting that ferns were uncomplicated. I like your word, Jacob, unburdened, as a better. We all try to aspire to live our lives unburdened. So that's what ferns have it on us there. The authors are Feiwei Li and Jacob Suisa. Feiwei and Jacob, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you.
Joining us is our next guest, Kara Jamo. She is the author of the book Atlas Obscura, Wildlife, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Living Wonders.
This book takes readers around the globe, from Antarctic deserts to lush jungles and into the deepest fathoms of the ocean. Wildlife reinvigorates our sense of wonder and amazement about the incredible creatures we share on our planet.
Kara, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with kind of the motivation behind this book. It's really fascinating to look at all the different animals, insects, marine life, et cetera, birds.
Microbiomes. I mean, it's crazy.
Who develop kind of defense mechanisms or ways to adapt to certain difficult environments, et cetera. Where does this start? What was the motivation behind it? What was the, was there a single animal or insect that you saw that, that's like, you know what, that's unbelievable. There's got to be more of this out there.
Yeah. So this is the third book in the Atlas Obscura book series. And the first couple books, the whole point of Atlas Obscura as a company and all of the books is to kind of like help people find wonder in the world, whether that's like in everyday life or by traveling and seeing something new. And so I'm a wildlife journalist. I write about interesting animals and plants. And like you said, like microbes and all these other amazing species that kind of live alongside us and have similar problems to us and similar goals, but have found really unique ways of addressing them. Mm. And so when they asked me to help out on this book, I was really excited because I'm really used to, you know, like writing about one species at a time, which is very cool and fun. But the idea of taking all these things that I knew about and finding new things and putting them together into a big book was really exciting because, like you said, there's just so much out there. And so the idea that we could try to collect even a small handful of these cool examples in one book was inspiring.
Yeah, and you got input from many different people. The research must have been pretty intense into deciding what you're going to place into the book. How far reaching did that research go?
Yeah, so it was definitely a very long and deep and intense process. I think I got a little bit obsessed with it, which in retrospect was good for the book, I think. But I can tell when I'm flipping through, I'm like, you know, this is the only thing I was thinking about for a few years. Mm. But I also had, a lot of help and collaboration. There are a lot of this book I wrote through talking to researchers and other people who have close relationships with some of these species. There are short interviews in the book that kind of detail those relationships and these different forms of expertise. So not just with scientists, but with people who have different kinds of relationships with the animals. And then I also collaborated with a number of writers from around the world who maybe also know these species really well because they live near them or they've studied them. And so we had writers from actually all seven continents file stories, which is cool. We had a story filed from Antarctica, which isn't something I expected to happen when we started this process, but which was very exciting to me. There's a short Antarctica section in the book in the deserts chapter, because Antarctica is actually the world's largest desert because it never rains there. So yeah, it was great. It was a real, like, it was a real collaborative effort, and then it was also a real obsessive effort by me.
Well, you move geographically from page to page, but the book does feel like you could flip it anywhere, and it's almost like a treasure hunt where you can find something interesting, and you don't necessarily have to read it end to end, but you can decide what adventure that you go on.
Yeah, that's a great comparison. I've heard it's been fun to sort of see how people react to the book and what they compare it to. I've also heard it compared to like a yearbook for the animal and plant kingdoms, which I thought was pretty funny. But yeah, it's organized by the chapters are each a different biome. So we have forests and rainforests, grasslands and tundras, deserts, mountains, oceans, cities and islands. And then within that, like you said, it's geographical. So you can get the feeling that you're traveling the whole world within a single chapter.
So what does it take for an animal or a species to qualify for the book? Let's say under mountains or so. What, give us an example of some species that the book highlights.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it's something I thought about a lot because in a book like this, to get that treasure hunt feeling, you really want to, and to also sort of get across the amazing diversity and interestingness of the world, you don't want to have anything be too like samey. Like for one thing, you don't want to include too many examples of one type of animal or plant, like mammals, you know, or trees at the expense of a different one. But then you also want to include things that are interesting for different reasons. So even within the mountains chapter, I guess one example of this is we have a section on snow leopards, which is an animal that I think people know about. But we tried to really dig deep and find some interesting facts about them that people might not know already. And we spoke to some experts, but then we also have a little section on the Andean cat, which was one of my favorite animals to learn about. It's another mountain cat, but it's so rare and hard to find that even people who research it for decades don't necessarily ever see it in person. A lot of the contact they have with this animal that they're experts in is through, you know, scat or footprints or camera trap footage. So really trying to sort of run the gamut between like, this is a well-studied and well-known animal, or this is one we barely get to encounter. So that's, yeah, one example of the spectrum.
It's really interesting you mentioned the snow leopard, because that's one of the books I read back when I was a teen or college or so, the Peter Matthiessen's amazing book. And that was one of the kind of the touchstones I used to pursue a career in the environmental field. So thank you for mentioning the snow leopard, because it was quite endangered. But I believe there's been some preservation and conservation activities associated with them.
Yes, people are definitely trying to help them thrive. And yeah, that book, I think, was a touchstone for a lot of people. That's another reason that an animal can end up in the book, is because it's had an impact on human culture in maybe like an unusual or specific way.
Along with the fascinating creatures that you give accounts of, you also cover how humans impact wildlife.
Yeah, absolutely. So we had some kind of rules for the book. You know, we didn't want to include domestic species because we had to limit ourselves somehow, right? But obviously the natural world and the human world are not separate. I know that you guys talk about that every week. Yeah. So we all interact and intersect, and I didn't want to leave that out of the book. So that's a big part of it.
And we had last week even quite a robust conversation about zebra mussels and how they wreak havoc on some water bodies because of the way that they will filter. And you, they're invasive species, but you have talked about mussels in a way that they're being utilized to study contaminants, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah, so the cities chapter, which is where those mussels appear, was one of the most interesting chapters for me to write, because it illustrates what you just said, how humans and other species actually interact all the time in all kinds of different ways. So these mussels that you're mentioning now are mostly swan mussels, but other freshwater mussels as well. And in Poland, basically the people who run the water supply and make sure that clean water is getting to people in the cities of Warsaw and Poznan and other large cities in Poland, they use these mussels as part of their sort of contamination alert system. So if you want to test water for contaminants, you kind of have two choices. One is that you can be super specific and do chemical tests, but then you can only really test for one thing at a time. Or you can try to cast a wider net. And the way that they've decided there to cast the wider net is to use these freshwater mussels who are very sensitive. When the water is clean, the mussels open up and they let the water go through them. And if there's something really bad in the water, the mussels literally clam up, they close their shells. And so within these water filtration plants, they have teams of mussels, I think maybe 8 at a time. And if enough of them close very tightly at the same time, a sensor triggers and they shut off the water and they try to figure out what's wrong using some of these more specific tests. But if the mussels are open and just living their lives, then they know that the water is safe for mussels and humans. And my favorite part about that story was that each mussel works for 3 months. And then after that, they get to retire. So they just put them back in the river. But it's a cool example of using the talents of these different species to help us, especially without harming the creatures, which I think is a really, really cool way of collaborating.
Well, along the lines and staying over there in far Eastern Europe, you actually have a section on Chernobyl called the Chernobyl Exclusion Zone, an entire ecosystem that, of course, humans fouled, let's say, but now nature has taken over. Talk a little bit about what's going on there.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Obviously, the Chernobyl explosion was a huge tragedy. And then since then, the place where it happens has become very interesting for a number of reasons. But I think for people who study wildlife, it's particularly interesting for two reasons. One is that you can study the impact that radiation has on the creatures who live around there. But then the other is you can study the sort of counterbalancing impact that not having people around has on a place where people used to be. And there are rewilding movements all over the world to kind of take land that's been used by humans and quote unquote give it back to nature, stop, you know, building on it or cutting down trees or whatever you might otherwise do. This is sort of a natural instance, not natural. This is a like an automatic or necessity-based instance of this because people can't be in this irradiated zone. And so it's an opportunity to study both of those things. And people have found some really interesting stuff there. Definitely, there's evidence that some of these creatures are doing badly, especially right after the radiation impact. But even, you know, years later, there are impacts from that. But not having human pressure is actually helping a number of species and making it a very biodiverse place. Out of this tragedy comes at least a place where we can get some interesting information.
Yeah, it is. It's a strange example of how, like you say, a tragedy, human caused, you know, radiating the environment, and then just leaving it alone and seeing how wild, kind of like what happened during COVID and the pandemic. You know, we stayed inside and we let wildlife return to areas that, or come back and explore areas that we had taken from them. So an interesting example there. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Kara Jaimo. She's the author of the book Atlas Obscura, Wildlife, an Explorer's Guide to the World's Living Wonders. Let's go down into one of my favorite places, the deep sea, because there's so much yet to be found down there. Give us some examples of creatures that populate the deep seas that are in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my favorite spreads to work on with a freelance contributor for this book was, we have a spread called A Deep Dive on Deep Dives. In addition to these like small profiles of species that are throughout the book, we tried to sometimes bring information together in a new way. We made a bar chart of like the deepest diving animals in the ocean, not just in terms of like, okay, they're going from the surface to a certain amount down, but like just in terms of the absolute value of the distance they travel. And I learned a lot from this. One of the funniest things in it is the southern elephant seal can dive 7,835 feet, which is the deepest diving non-whale mammal. But then because of that, the southern elephant seal louse, which is a little louse that lives on the elephant seal, can dive that far too because it's attached to the flippers of the seal. So I thought that was kind of fun to learn about. There's also, you know, all these really incredible creatures that we only really get to see at their worst, because by the time they get to the surface, they don't look like they're supposed to, and they're not feeling very well. But looking at them in their natural habitat, they're glorious. So like the Pacific football fish, when people find them occasionally on the beach, they look sort of like blobby and strange, but down in their habitat, which is down to 3,000 feet sometimes, they're just like these monstrous, impressive predators that have this cool little dangly lure, and they're incredibly good hunters. They have these spiky teeth. It really is a whole other world down there that we're just beginning to understand.
And I particularly looked at that fish, and to give you an example, the listeners out there, what it looks like, it's like the luring fish in Finding Nemo.
Yeah, exactly.
You can get that visual there, except for I think they made it look a little bit more enticing in Finding Nemo, because that fish is, I don't know if it got like really drew the look straw. It's a very interesting looking animal, but that leads me to a lot of the times people tend to care about or lean into the creatures and the animals that are cuddly and furry and cute, but we don't often pay attention to the ones that aren't so cuddly and cute, and how much the role that they also play in ecosystems and keeping our landscapes alive and well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I said before that I tried hard to balance different types of species in the book, but I think I do have a real soft spot for insects in particular. So I think there are a lot of bugs in the book. And that was my way of maybe trying to address that, because like you said, there are so many amazing species that are not necessarily as visually appealing as others, although, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder. I think bugs are often quite beautiful and cute, but I understand that other people don't. So you'll definitely find a lot of creepy crawlies in this book. bats, bugs, strange-looking fish, but hopefully readers will come away with a new appreciation for them and, like you said, all the things that they do.
How has a warming planet, warming oceans, et cetera, impacted some of these species? What changes can we, or are we seeing with respect to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was kind of, you know, it ended up being a theme throughout the book because you can't ignore it. Climate change is happening everywhere. It's happening to everyone. And it's happening so quickly that even these species that are so adaptable, so great at over evolutionary time, you know, solving these problems, meeting their goals, it's happening too fast for many of them to keep up. I found this was especially apparent in the mountains chapter, at least the way it turned out. Almost every entry in that chapter was like heavily inflected by climate change. So for example, and to give a bug example, we have a section on glacier stoneflies, which live beneath glaciers in Glacier National Park. So, you know, often in mountainous areas, and they live under glaciers, so they need glaciers to survive, to like go through their life cycle. And because of this, they are some of the species who are most clearly impacted by climate change because climate change is melting the glaciers. And so there's not a lot of hope for them in terms of survival. And they are just these like very sort of standard looking buggy bugs. But I wanted to make sure that we included them because they are on the vanguard of, you know, this big sweeping problem that is affecting everyone. On the flip side of that, a couple pages later, we have a story about American pikas or pikas. Yeah. I actually still don't know how to pronounce that. Sorry. Yeah. Is it pikas or pikas?
I don't know. That makes two of us.
But pikas, you know, they're so cute and furry. And like you said, they're very charismatic. Yeah. People love them and they have this adorable habit of sort of like harvesting flowers and plants. And there are all these cute pictures of them with little bouquets in their mouths because they're going to store them away for winter.
Right.
They also are affected by climate change because they are like big and fuzzy and they don't want it to be super warm. It's not good for them physiologically. But researchers who observe them have shown that they, even as the temperatures get hotter in the mountains where they live, they just change their behavior. So they come out at different times of day. They stay in their caves when it gets too hot. So they are adapting, at least for now, behaviorally. But these are, you know, two different stories happening in the American mountains because of climate change that may end very differently. And again, it's just interesting to see how it's all playing out.
Well, again, the name of the book is Atlas Obscura Wildlife, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Living Wonders. Kara, where the book is out and available now, is there a website associated with it too?
Yeah, so this is an Atlas Obscura book. It was produced, by the Atlas Obscura company. I used to work as a staff writer there. You can find more information on the book and the sort of Atlas Obscura view of the world on atlasobscura.com, but you can find the book in bookstores and online bookstores and pretty much everywhere.
Well, it's a beautiful book, and it is chock full of incredible information. Kara, thanks so much for joining us here on This Green Earth.
Yeah, thank you guys so much.
We got about 2 minutes.
2 minutes for
a news item
about something really, really important.
Okay.
To about 90% of us.
Okay.
Coffee.
Oh, yes. Hugely important.
But this is interesting. This
Drinking
is with respect
Nile.
To the European Union. Farmers in Africa that produce some of the world's most prized coffee are in a scramble to comply with new European Union environmental rules that require those farmers to document the origin of every shipment of coffee beans to Europe. Now, this new measure came into force at the beginning of this year, and it's designed to prevent deforestation driven by agricultural expansion. To comply, farmers, the African farmers, must provide geolocation data to show that their coffee was not grown on land where forests have recently been cut down. So it's a, you know, As of, again, at the beginning of this year, any big producers of coffee in Africa that cannot do so will lose access to the vast European market.
You know, I have really mixed feelings about that because obviously deforestation across the planet is a huge issue. So you want people to be more cognizant, but also it's hard if you've been a farmer for years and years and years to shift and try to change and make that happen quickly.
Right. Well, those farmers are saying that it costs money that they have to spend to do this mapping.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, Ethiopia is the top coffee producer in Africa, and the crop accounts for 35% of the mm-hmm. country's revenue. The Arabica variety originated in the country's southwestern highlands. More than a third of Ethiopia's coffee goes to Europe. So that's all now requires additional mapping and documenting as to where these beans come from.
Can there be resources sent to help with this, or are they just laying this burden completely on them?
We're going to have to continue that conversation.
All right.
That's a good question.
And I think it's a good conversation, too, because many of us do enjoy coffee and we want to do it sustainably. Or
coffee that's coming to the U.S., not a problem. Of course, it's going to become more expensive because of tariffs,
right,
which actually makes Hawaiian coffee and coffee from Puerto Rico, more competitive because they don't face tariffs. So look for coffee from Puerto Rico.
Interesting. A lot of Arabica also comes from Vietnam. Okay.
All right. Let's to be go. Continued. You can email us your ideas for topics and stories you'd like us to cover too. thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.